Hi, we here at the North American Christians in Social Work want to thank you for selecting this continuing education course. We appreciate your interest in pursuing ongoing trainings sensitive to the thoughtful integration of faith, social work practice, and spirituality. We hope that this training meets or exceeds your expectations and is useful to you. If you have any questions during or after the training, please don't hesitate to contact us at info@nacsw.org. Thanks again and enjoy the training.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
And thank you for attending the workshop. I'm a little nervous. I was told I'm actually recording this for their podcast. So they felt that this workshop was very relevant and important to substance abuse. So, and I don't have a clicker, so I'll come in here and move in this. Okay. So one of the things that I want to do today, and I'm going to try to balance my time because I really want to do a case study with you as well. I'm going to talk to you about working with substance abuse, which many of you probably already have the experience in working with substance abuse, and looking at some spirituality-based perspectives. Also talking about understanding the client-worker relationship and what we as providers bring to the context of working with clients who are addressing substance abuse, and how do you introduce spirituality in that context. But what I wanted to also do is look at the FICA spirituality assessment, and this is an assessment that was developed by physicians that was used primarily at end of life and to assess a person's will to live. And so in looking at that particular assessment, I felt like, thank you very much, I felt like the FICA assessment would be a really good assessment as a way to introduce talking about spirituality and making it comfortable for our clients to be able to bring that topic up. So I want to talk to you about that today. So I wanted to start off with spirituality. And there are a lot of definitions around what spirituality is. Most people relate spirituality to religion. And spirituality is different. It has different meanings for different people. And so I looked at two. And so the two that jumped out at me was one by Blakely, where individuals' beliefs, faith in, and personal relationship with God / a higher being or higher power that transcends human limitations. And the reason why I looked at these two in particular is because when you think about substance abuse, the 12-step programs, right? They talk about the context of a higher power. Tertsky looks at it from a spiritual life includes the ability of a person to be responsible, to be trusting, to achieve a deeper level of intimacy, and realize his or her own personal growth. And oftentimes when a person is coming in for substance abuse counseling or substance abuse treatment, they've reached their bottom, right? So the bottom. So they're literally starting over. And how do we as providers help them to move into a space? And so understanding what spirituality is for your client is what's important, not for you. Right? We oftentimes have our own definition of what we believe spirituality is, and we'll give that to the client and not really understand what their context of spirituality is. And that's where the FICA assessment really works well. So when we look at spirituality, it's understanding what does it do for our clients, right? It gives them a purpose of existence. Oftentimes, depending on how and why a person came into a space where they're abusing substances can play a part in their purpose. If you have a person who is self-medicating as a way to deal with trauma, who is self-medicating because it was introduced to them very early in their lives, most times by the time they come into treatment, they really don't feel like they have a purpose for existence. And so the whole idea about getting better and what it means in the context of existence is lost. It's a way to better oneself. And these are things that we would want to translate to our clients as we talk to them. We have to understand that these are not things that are going to happen right away. And sometimes as providers, we are excited about a person who even made a decision to come into treatment, that we sometimes will move to this space before taking the necessary steps to go forward. It helps to build self-esteem. It also helps in delaying gratification. For an individual who is in a place where they may be abusing substances, oftentimes it's to meet an immediate need. It is to quell pain. It is to move away from things that may have been traumatic, or to even take a space to where you're trying to forget those things. But the most important piece also too is to have the person think about the long-term consequences of their actions, right? So in substance abuse, one of the things oftentimes that you'll see, they talk about consequential thinking and the context of understanding that the decisions that you make oftentimes are going to have consequences that come along with them. So when we look at spirituality, these are all of the things that spirituality can help to promote when we're working with clients who are addressing substance abuse. Okay, so the helper, who's that? Right? We are the helpers. And oftentimes, that's what we come in with this big hat on, right? We are the helpers. I'm going to save you. And here's the thing that we have to understand. Each person in this room, you have to ask yourself, why did you come into this profession? Why did you choose to be a social worker? Why did you choose to be a counselor? Sometimes it's either connected to you directly or indirectly based on your own experiences. So we have to be very careful and mindful of the role that we're playing when we talk about helper. And I'm going to go into depth around what we need to bring and what we need to be conscious of. So as the helper, the social worker, the counselor, your role, understand what your role is to foster the client's journey to recovery. Right? So it's not for you to drag them through, but it's for you to guide them through that process. They're not going to move as fast as you think they should. They're not going to move as fast as you want them to. So you have to meet the client where they are. But in our own zealous sometimes, you're going to do this. We're going to get you through this 18-month program. You're going to get a job, and you're going to find a place to live, and you're going to, right? 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 So part of that is, think about it. I always look at it as a journey, and that's how I explain it to my clients. You are about to embark on a journey, and I am your guide. I'm not going to pull you through this. We're going to go through this at your pace, but also explain it to them based on why they may be in treatment, because some people are in treatment involuntarily, right? And explaining the guidelines, right? So I'm going to help you through this journey, but we have to explore the guidelines, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. So you have to establish very clear boundaries at the start, and it's important to maintaining that relationship, whether it's therapeutic or whatever. If you don't establish boundaries, it'll get away from you. Your clients are not your friends. They are sharing very intimate things about them. And so you, as a professional, have to be very careful of compassion fatigue, right? Internalizing and finding your own way to purge a lot of this information that you're getting when you walk out the door. And I'll talk to you about some of the things that I do as a way to help me with that. So also, it's the provider's responsibility to keep the process realistic for the client and yourself. Because oftentimes our clients will come in, and especially if they're mandated, they already see themselves leaving. All right, so I got to be here for how many months?
Right.
I got, 12 months? All right, so by the time we get to month 3, this is what I'm going to be doing. You have to keep them grounded. Keep them realistic in the context of, you know what, by month 3, you may not be in that space. And here's the thing, although you being mandated for 12 months, you have to really think about what happens after the 12 months, right? Right? The key is encouraging the client to express their feelings and use their coping skills. Now, I always find this is the biggest challenge. The person's coming in, a mandated, I don't want to be here, I don't trust you, you're against me, everyone's against me, and if I don't do what I'm supposed to do, you're going to make me go back to jail, right? So part of that is encouragement is the key to that. They're scapegoating. Somebody has to be the blame for where they are. And so separating out, having those boundaries that I mentioned before, is very, very important to you as a provider to be able to stay in a space where you can encourage your clients. Now, I'm on a mic, so maybe I shouldn't say it, but we always are in situations where you may have certain clients that when they're coming, it's like, right? And part of that is, that's when you have to really think about where you are. Because if you have that moment, the encouragement is not there for you or for the client, right? So a big part of that is recognizing how you're feeling, but also why you're feeling that way. Because a lot of times, it's not about the client, right? Transference, right? So it's being mindful of where you are in this process. Okay, so I'm going to keep moving here so I can be mindful of the time. So here's some do's and don'ts to helping. Do encourage expression. Explore their strengths, and I'm going to talk about that when I look at some of the some spiritually based approaches, the strengths perspectives I'm going to look at. Be honest. That's the most important thing. That's the one thing that I learned in working in substance abuse treatment is I have to be honest with the clients because my expectation of them is I want them to be honest. I always say, if I say anything to offend you, if even my movements offended you, I need you to tell me, right? You have to keep it honest. Most important, you have to check your own emotions. And oftentimes we find ourselves doing that regularly, checking your own emotions. I'm going to share a quick story with you. When I first started, I was working with a young lady who was 6 months pregnant. She was diagnosed with AIDS. She was an active crack user. And she came into my office because they wanted me to work with her in the context of getting her to minimize her use of crack. I struggled with her. I had to do this often. Supervision became very, very important for me because I myself had just had my own child. And so there was a lot of feelings that were happening because I was blaming her for bringing a child into the world who more than likely was going to have crack in his or her system. And so I had to step back. And I usually would step back prior to her coming into counseling to kind of just do a check-in with myself, check my emotions, check where I'm at, how am I feeling about her, reading over her information, what's happening in this particular moment so that I could help her. Because I wouldn't be encouraging if I didn't do that, right? What we don't want to do is we don't want to give our opinions. Sometimes that's hard. We don't want to be judgmental. And when you check in with your emotions, the likelihood of minimizing your judgment is there, right? Don't make excuses for your clients. You have to tell them what you see. Don't rationalize their behavior. So if someone comes in and you get a call and they've had a dirty urine, right? Don't rationalize. They're going to come in and give you all type of stories. That's when you have to be honest with them. Don't give your opinions about what's being said, but just keep those boundaries and stay honest, even if they're going to get upset about it. Don't take over your client's recovery. And that's something oftentimes we do subconsciously. We don't recognize that we're doing it because we want them to succeed. We really want them to succeed. We want them to be off of drugs. We want them to be productive people in society. And so one of the things that can happen is we start to take over by telling them what they're going to do and not having it as a reciprocal process where they are the ones who are making a decision about what they want to do and we're helping them through this journey. Okay, so with all of this, the whole approach to this is that we want to keep this client-centered, okay? And so when we think about a client-centered approach to working in substance abuse, One of the things we look at is that it builds on establishing a partnership between the provider and the client. So this is where we talk about working together, where decision-making and responsibilities for care is shared. So if you think that there's something that would work for your client, how would you tell them that without taking over their recovery? What do you think you would say to them? No wrong answers.
I might say something like, can I make a suggestion?
Absolutely. Right? I would recommend. This sounds great. I think that's a good thing for you to do, but have you thought about this? Right? So it's a way that you present that where it becomes this reciprocal process in them not feeling like you're pushing things on them, right? Because they're more likely to be receptive to what you're giving them if they don't feel like they're being forced to take on certain things. The main focus is on building trust and open communication. And so these all kind of play into one another, because as you build that relationship, and that's a process that's ongoing throughout your whole experience with this particular client or clients that you work with, you want to recognize the strengths and capabilities of the clients, because oftentimes they're so broken that they don't see it themselves. And it could be something, I don't want to say as simple as, because it's not simple, but even making the decision to come into treatment, making the decision to stay in treatment. And if it's mandated, completing the process, recognizing how you change through the process are the things that are very important. You also want to allow space for the provider to guide. And so again, that's the guiding in the journey, looking at it as a journey, not being three steps ahead of your client, but actually either standing next to them in a metaphorical type of way, or being behind them and watching them as they move to kind of help them through that process. So when we use this client-centered approach, it allows the provider and the client to learn continuously and reinforcing the success throughout the entire process. The operative word here is reinforcing success. Oftentimes, our clients don't see their own success because they're walking through this with their eyes closed. They're walking through with their eyes closed, and all they see is the door. When is this going to be over? I'm in this treatment center. I don't want to be here. They have all these rules. I can't go out. You tell me when I could leave. You have to go with me when I'm going to the doctor. What is this? I don't want to do this. So they move through this process where, what do I need to do to just get out? That doesn't help the treatment process because it increases the risk of them falling right back into where they were, right? Okay. So when we look at spirituality in the recovery process, and so one of the things that's important, and I'm going to slow down a little bit because this, at least I have some time, I want to go over this case study as well, is that the spirituality in the recovery process reflects on the important aspect of human diversity. And let me explain to you what I mean by human diversity. As much as we are the same, we are very, very different. And what makes us different? So everyone, there's the
values.
I heard somebody say something here. Temperament. Your temperament.
Experiences.
Personality, experiences. That's the diversity, right? So two people, as it was said, I sat in on a workshop prior to, two people can experience the same exact thing, but how you process that is very different. And we learn a lot of it has to do with brain functioning.
Right.
But as a college professor and a therapist, a lot of that also has to do with when we think about how you grow up, right? You go from a psychodynamic perspective. All of that impacts on decisions that we make. Our experiences from when we were younger impacts the decisions that we make as we become older. So if I experience trauma in my household, and my family refuses to acknowledge the trauma, and I can't live with it, what am I going to do? I'm going to try any way that I can to suppress that. So I'm going to use substances that's going to impact my brain. It's going to impact my thought process. It's going to impact how I perceive things. Spirituality is a great source of strength for our clients. It allows them to establish some sense of purpose for their existence. It allows them to develop a relationship with their higher being. And this is typically when I talk with clients and I say to them, do you consider yourself to be a spiritual person? And the response that I get 9 times out of 10 is, well, I can't remember the last time I went to church. 99%. Right? Right. And I'll say to them, but that's not what I'm asking you. I didn't ask you when you fellowshipped. I'm asking you about your relationship. Right. And so being able to help them understand that the spirituality is helping them to develop a relationship with God or their higher being. And that's something else I'm going to talk about that we have to be very careful about, is because if I worship God and someone else is not Christian that I'm actually working with, I can't push that on the person. So I encourage them to tell me what their higher being is. What does that look like for them, right? I had an individual come in who told me he was atheist, that he didn't believe in God. But by the time I finished the assessment, he believed in something. He was able to identify that and often called out to the Lord according to his conversation. But he said he didn't believe in God. But it's not my place to pass a judgment on him because he says he doesn't believe in God. But as his clinician, I'm listening to everything that he's saying. And so that he went to Catholic school all his life. His life was rough, right? So part of that is you're telling me you don't believe in God, but you feel like he didn't show up when you felt like he was supposed to. So you severed a relationship. Now, I'm not going there to tell a person you need to establish a relationship again. I'm going there to say, how does spirituality help you to establish some sense of purpose in your existence, whatever that is, right? Okay. So when we look at this recovery process, the spirituality also helps to foster a sense of meaning, purpose, and mission in their lives. What do they want to do? What did they do, or what were some of their dreams before they began using substances? Where did they see themselves? I've worked with nurses. I've even worked with doctors. I've worked with a young man. He was he worked for the city. He worked for the city of New York in a pretty prominent position and got caught up. And ended up losing everything. And so in talking to him, we had to redefine what his mission was going to be. And he realized that he didn't want to go back to that. His new mission became helping other people in treatment. And so what did that process look like? What do you need to do that? Right. So, again, looking at the door. Right. So for him, it was, well, I'm going to get through this and I'm going to start doing counseling right away. Well, what does that mean? It's a process. Do you need to go back to school? Do you need to get a certification? And so those are the things that I would build on as a way to help this person use that to keep moving forward. Providers can use spirituality to help the clients focus on forgiveness, building healthy relationships with others, because also that's a big part of it too. Right? Their broken family relationship, friend relationships, children relationship, marital relationships, and also relationships with themselves. Right? Blaming themselves for things that happened. Blaming themselves for decisions that they've made, choices that they've made. And so forgiveness is the biggest part, but it's hard. It's hard. Right. People oftentimes say, well, if I forgive this person, then I'm letting them off the hook and I'm supposed to be in their lives again. And I tell people, forgiveness is about acknowledging the pain from the past. That's really what it is. And making a decision on how you want to move forward. Because someone did something to you, when you forgive them, you free yourself. Doesn't mean that you have to still be in their presence. They have to live with that now. And so helping them, this is a big part of people being able to maintain their sobriety is being able to move into a space where they can forgive others, but also forgive themselves. And usually I start with forgiving themselves first. Right. I don't start with having them forgive other people, because then they miss themselves. And what happens is in forgiving other people, they start to blame. The blame starts to fall on them, and it makes it that much harder. So I'll usually start with them forgiving themselves. So some of the processes, when we look at, I'm going to talk about two different approaches that I've used in working with recovery. But as the provider, we have to be careful not to impose, and this is really, really important, not to impose your own religious or spiritual views on your clients. And even if those views connect to the client, that you have the same views, you have to be very, very careful, because once you do that, you've crossed boundaries. Disclosure is a lot of literature. There's a lot of debates around how much do we disclose, when do we disclose, how do you disclose, what does disclosure do, right? Does disclosure blur the boundaries in regards to the work that you're going to do with the client? Disclosure at times could be very, very healthy, but it's in regards to how you do that. Because if it's opinionated in regards to how you're giving that information, it changes the dynamics of that relationship. The spirit is us, right? And so a big piece of that is when I talk about recognizing your emotions, understanding where you are, not being judgmental. When I use those pieces, right, a big portion of this is when you recognize where you are spiritually, you're helping the other person the word you use, which is so important, to embrace it, their own. So recognizing yours, right? Not moving to a space where the session becomes, now I'm the client and they're helping me. It's helping them to tap into, I'm going to come right to you, helping them to tap into what their spirituality is. And I'm going to show, the FICA really does that. And I'm realizing time is going by so fast. I'm going to show you that with the FICA, how the FICA is laid out, where exactly what you're saying in terms of recognizing your own, you help them to embrace theirs. Yes.
I was just going to say the caveat you made, though, was we influence rather than impose. And that was how I understood.
Okay.
It.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. Yes. Yes. And the influence part, you're not going to be able to get away from, because we are human, right? And we feel and we have relationships. And so part of what I oftentimes will do is try to assess what is their relationship. What is spirituality to them? And not saying, that's why I talked about disclosure, disclosing, knowing when to disclose, how to disclose, what is appropriate, what is not appropriate. And so even for yourself, if you acknowledge that you have a spiritual relationship, I don't think that is imposing in any way. I don't think that's judgmental. That is allowing the person to see that, you know what? I'm human. I'm human just like you. That's showing empathy towards the person. And so it allows them, it's part of that trust building that we talk about, because sometimes you have to give a little bit of trust in order to get it back, right? So exactly what you're saying. And I think part of why I mentioned about when I use the word impose, and I use that word purposely, because people have a tendency to, I'm generalizing here, okay, to not do what you said, but to say, this is what it is. Have you thought about this? Well, you have. Well, why haven't you been to church in a while? So those are the kind of things where, this is the extreme of looking at how somebody may address the substance abuse treatment process because of time limits, because of where the client already sees themselves, right? And as a way to help them through, let's move away from imposition, right? To help them through, we're now pushing them into a place, okay, so let's get you set up. So, okay, we looked at spirituality, and not looking at spirituality is not walking them through the journey of spirituality. And so that's why when we think about that journey, I'm not in front of you. I can't be in front of you. I can stand next to you, right? But standing next to you is an acknowledgement that spirituality is a part of me as well, right? Okay, so I'm going to move, because this is going faster than I thought. So two perspectives that I look at when I use spirituality is strength, the strengths perspective, and empowerment perspective. And so with the strength perspective, it's utilized to utilizes clients to help them identify strengths that they have and help them to understand their existence and purpose for staying in recovery. And with the empowerment perspective, it gives the client a sense of self-determination. And in social work, we look at our code of ethics, right? Self-determination is one of our key codes, and ownership for becoming substance-free and staying in recovery. So to empower them is to allow them to see what they bring to the process. And if spirituality is a strength that they bring to the process, that's fabulous. If they don't identify that as a strength, and one of the reasons sometimes they don't is because sometimes we don't ask. Right? It's not always part of the assessment process. And so introducing that as a way is another way of being able to see that in terms of where they are, because sometimes individuals I found that I've worked with are a lot more spiritual than I thought. Right? So I'm going to go through these quickly, because it's already going on 11 o'clock and I want to do my case study. Right? So with the strength perspective, again, we're focusing on their resources. We're looking at their assets and their knowledge that they bring to this change process. And what are the resources? Resources could be friends. Resources could be a support system. Resources could be, connections within the community are some of the things. You're going to see that with the FICA, that's some of what they look at. An emphasis on working on collaboratively with the client, and I talked about that with that client-centered approach that we looked at. And again, it promotes the self-determination. And so in this context, spirituality represents an important strength that can foster resilience for the client and finding meaningful in things that are difficult. So if they're blaming themselves for trauma that happened, and I've worked with many people who've experienced sexual abuse, and oftentimes this resonates in terms of them being able to find some meaning in this difficult time, that's not good. But how do you move from that? Mm-hmm. What does that mean to you? How do you process that? And so that plays a big part. And it also specifically related to substance misuse, spirituality is also linked to positive outcomes. And so using that helps catapult that individual to a place where they can see that things are going to get better for them. When we look at also the internal strengths in terms of the client being able to lean on their own beliefs to support the decisions that they make. And that these decisions are directly related to what they give meaning to. And also looking at some of the external strengths, and we talked about that. So when you look at resources in terms of the connections within the community, who are they connected to? Are they connected to a church? Are they connected to an organization? Are they involved? How can they give back? So when we think about a person giving back and what that really means for them, oftentimes that helps them. Because now they're helping other people. So I broke it out in two perspectives. So when we look at strength for the client, means by which an individual is open to identifying supports and resources that can support the recovery process. That's the client. But for the therapist, your role is you're encouraging the client to think outside of the box, right? You're introducing activities that tap into their inner strengths, not yet recognized by the client. And so introducing spirituality is one of those strengths that they may not recognize. And so being able to think outside of the box and how you can use that as a way to build yourself is really important. Okay. With the empowerment perspective, this is looking at helping the client to discover and expand on resources and tools within and around them. So it's their immediate environment. So who in your program is like-minded? Who in your program do you trust? Because you may have to, it may be a situation where they learn to build that trust, not with necessarily you as a therapist or the counselor, but maybe with someone else that they work, that they're in the program with, someone that's in the group. But how do you develop that healthy relationship with that person within the group, right? Excuse me. Helping the process to assist the client in using their strengths to overcome the challenges. So when we look at it, you're acknowledging the strengths. You acknowledge each time that they tap into those strengths as a way to continue to empower them to keep using and tapping into those particular strengths. So this all leads to what I look at, or you know, what's looked at, is a positive and optimistic view of challenges that people have in their lives. So it's helping them to look at it differently, for them to understand it differently, for them to develop a new meaning for the space that they are in now. And how do they build from that in order to have a productive life, right? And so these two, I believe, play an integral part in that healing process. So you have the strengths perspective, you have the empowerment perspective, you also have, and you use this in the context of helping them to learn how to forgive, which is a big part of healing. So when we look at empowerment for the client, what does this mean? It means by which an individual becomes able to control their circumstances, right? And circumstances is what? What could be some circumstances that they can have control over or believe they have control over?
Their friends, their associations.
Associations in their lives, right? Even in terms of if they're moving into another space, where do they want to live? That might sound simple, right? But where do you want to live? Having a choice about a job.
What do you want to do?
Correct. Right. Do you want to go back to school? So a lot of that plays in that. So if they feel that they are at a place to where they can make choices, because oftentimes choices are taken away, depending on the circumstances, they don't have choices. And depending on where they're at, the decisions are being made for them in every step. So having them feel like, okay, I'm moving in a place where now I can start to make decisions for myself, I think that's important. For the therapist, you're engaging in a set of activities with your client that aims to reduce, so here we go, a sense of powerlessness. All of the power has been taken when they go into treatment.
Right.
Right? And so part of it is helping them to move away from that sense. And most important thing, moving out of a stigmatized group. The group that we're talking about, it's stigmatized and marginalized in society right out the gate. And so helping them to empower themselves and move from that is part of this process of being able to heal. So healing and recovery is helping them to restore balance and wholeness in their lives. And what does that mean? Let me give you some examples. That could mean establishing a relationship with your children again, right? Even if they're in foster care, even if they're not with you, how do you establish that? Establishing relationships with people you feel that you may that may have been hurt through your process. Identifying what is it that you want to do past recovery, right? Looking at how do you stay in recovery and what are some positive things in order to do that. So it's creating what I call this equilibrium between mind, body, and spirit. They all interconnect. So if you think healthy and you feel healthy, the spirituality piece plays a major part. That is the arch for both aspects of that. Okay. And so this requires a supportive environment, and these are just some examples of supportive environments, but I'm giving you this, so we look at this case study that I literally gonna have about 10 minutes to do. Your therapist or counselor is an important part of that process. Family and friends. And when I say family, how I define family is, family does not have to be blood. Right? I think sometimes, right, you look at that, it doesn't have to be blood. We have people that we consider family and probably do more for you than your family does. But it's who they define as their family. A sponsor, right? So when we think about sponsor, we think about AA. But I think in all contexts, a person should have someone that they can call when they feel down, someone that they could call if they're in a situation where something seems really tough and they need to just talk it out. As crazy as it is, all of us in this room have a sponsor. I called a few people before I started talking today. Right? I needed some encouragement. Like, oh my gosh, I'm so nervous. And so the feedback that I got was like, you could do this. You've done this before. So we all have, when we talk about sponsors, we all have that. Somebody that you can reach out to. And I say church or spiritual family. When we talk about a spiritual family, what that means is that, again, like-minded people. Somebody that you could call and pray with if you need to, right? Somebody that you could call and say, you know what, this is where I'm at, but I'm not sure how I'm feeling. And that person is going to listen to you and give you some words of encouragement. And that family could be small. It could be one person. It could be two. You might have a group of people that you have on a group chat, because that's a new thing now. You group chat where you just put in there, look, lift me up. I'm going to do this. Can you lift me up? And people understand that and they encourage you in that way. So these are some of all the processes or people who play a part in that healing and recovery. So as the social worker or the counselor role, we want to help your clients to tackle the problems from the very beginning. And what is that? Establishing boundaries, helping them identify what it is that they need to do. And then you incorporate what it is that's expected, right? With the timelines and things like that. You're bolstering the motivation of your client. You work with your client's feelings constantly and not take anything personally, even if they start blaming you for things that are happening. And you help them restructure their thoughts by gently giving them information. So restructuring the thoughts is another way of having them move in this space of recovery. Because oftentimes the thoughts go back. We talk about flashbacks in the, right? So they flash back. They think about these experiences. They even will have, in terms of the experience, it could also be emotional in the context of what they have. So your role is maintaining their progress. You want to update and review with them as much as possible. You want to develop power, so you want to assert your client's privileges in the worker-client relationship. And you want to have the client take ownership of their process. Oftentimes it's, can you do this for me? No, I cannot. How about I sit here and you make the phone call, right? You want to go look at an apartment? How about I make arrangements for someone to go along with you so that this way you feel comfortable when you're looking at it, that they can tell you what the neighborhood looks like, that they can tell you, you know, what are some of the things you need to look at. Helping them to recognize their change. You want to offer feedback. You want to reflect on their actions, right? I don't know if you should have said that to that person. That didn't feel nice to me. So how do you think they felt about that? Having to recognize that. You want to examine their behavior towards staying in recovery. Because sometimes we see things that they don't. Sometimes they may make friends with somebody that you already know is just in it for the ride and I'm going to get out. And you see where this person is. You see that this person is moving in a place that they're going to do well, but they're latching onto what's familiar and helping them to understand how to move past that. So I'm going to move right to the assessment tool. Let me move to the assessment tool. So let me just talk to you a little bit about FICA. FICA is an assessment tool that was developed by a physician of the name of Puchowski in 1996. Her and some of her colleagues put together an assessment tool for end of life as a way to assess a will to live. And what I liked about it is that it explored particular components that I believe are transferable to working in substance abuse. And I'm in the process now of putting together a research study as a way to see how effective this component can work in substance abuse, and also pushing for it to become part of the overall assessment. So we look at FICA. FICA looks at four components: faith and beliefs, importance and influence. So all of this sounds right, things that we've talked about. community, and address. And I'm going to talk to you about what those mean. So when we look at it in terms of breaking it down, how I'm looking at it could be used in substance abuse. Does faith and belief in a higher power exist? So this is part of your, when a client comes into for substance abuse treatment, whether they're going into a TC or they're going into a local community or they're going into a hospital, if we make the spirituality as a part of the overall assessment, what it does, it breaks down this uncomfortable place that some people oftentimes are in based on their own, as we say, our own spirituality. It allows for dialogue to happen, a discussion to happen. When we look at the influence, can this existence have influence on or be seen as important to a person's recovery? And these are questions that you can ask the clients in terms of where they are with their own faith or their spirituality. It helps you to look at what kind of supports are in the community or what's important to the client themselves. What do they perceive as important when we think about community? And it doesn't have to be, do you go to church, right? So it's looking at how do they define community and what is important for them in regards to that. And lastly, how are these issues can be addressed in the client's treatment? So how do you infuse this into the substance abuse treatment that you have with the client, right? So in terms of FICA, FICA will open up the door for providers to be able to have a discussion, an open discussion with their clients about how spirituality could help them in their recovery. So that you as the client, one, don't have to always necessarily tap into your own experience. Your own experience is going to come into it, but you don't have to use your own experience as a way to introduce it into the assessment process. And so this makes it a little more comfortable for the introduction of spirituality coming into substance abuse treatment and assessment, right? So one of the things that I wanted to do was I wanted to, and I literally have 5 minutes. I talk too much. I'm going to, because I really wanted to get your feedback on this. And I don't know, I tried to make a lot of copies. What is this here? And I don't think I made a lot of copies. I passed around a, let me do it like this. I passed around a, if you can break it up on each side, maybe. I passed around a sign-up sheet. If you want me to, I can send you the slides. I could also send you this case study and the questions that I have. And this is just something to think about. So I'm going to read it really quickly in the 5 minutes that I have, and I just wanted to maybe have a conversation. If there's not enough, if you're willing to share with people, that would be great. Okay, so this is a case study, not my case study, but this is a case study that I got from the Macy's Foundation. They had a research grant, and they put together a whole plethora of case studies, but I thought this one was relevant. Suzanne has come by the free drop-in counseling clinic where you work to get some information and advice. Suzanne is a 22-year-old single woman who's been living with her boyfriend, Jack, in Manhattan's Lower East Side for the last 4 years. She and Jack have been heroin addicts for more than 4 years. When Suzanne was 10 years old, her father, whom she says was a very hard drinker, left her mom and the kids and never came back. At 14, she started drinking and smoking marijuana. At 16, she dropped out of high school, and at 18, she moved in with Jack. He introduced her to heroin. She reports using about a half a gram of heroin per day just to be able to function and feel comfortable. In order to pay for the heroin and pay the rent on the apartment, Jack doesn't work. Instead, she works the streets at night. She usually drinks 4 or 5 beers each night before going out to work. If she can't score enough heroin, she will try to score either some Valium or Klonopins to tide me over, this is her word, tie me over until I get you, until I can get some horse. She says she's tried cocaine, but I really didn't care for the high all that much. Suzanne tells you that the alcohol and heroin helped to calm her nerves and get her through the night. She and Jack are not having sex all that much. When they do make love, he never wears a condom. He says that's what makes him different from her Johns. which is true because I won't work without a condom. This is Suzanne. Lately, she's noticed that her breasts have become swollen and more tender. She also hasn't had her period in the last 12 weeks. She's pretty sure she's pregnant and knows it's her boyfriend's baby. However, she's more sure she can stop using dope or wants to have the baby, even though Jack wants her to keep it. She's really confused at what she should do and is asking for you to help her with some decisions. Her friend Catherine, who works with her at night, told her not to stop using dope if she's pregnant because it's worse for the baby than to keep using. I just don't know what I should do. So this is a case study of a young lady who's coming in 22. So what I did was thinking about if this person came in, this is something for you to think about, this person came in for you, what is the most prevalent issue with this case? Oh, I have 5 minutes.
Her pregnancy.
Okay, right? So how would you, if we think about from a FICA perspective, in this assessment, her pregnancy is the most prevalent thing. How would you approach her fostering her recovery, knowing that she's pregnant and she's a heroin user who's using a half a gram a day, that now we think from a human behavior perspective, this baby is ingesting this heroin as well, right? So if you had to think about FICA, which is part of your assessment, what would you tap into? And everything that you're saying connects to FICA, mm-hmm. right? Because we're looking at her ambivalence. What could that be connected to? We're looking at her strengths, right? And so if we're going from this perspective, right, and I have a series of questions here, but if we're going from this perspective, just with these two, because I got to end in 2 minutes, we're going from this perspective, one of the things that I want you to think about is looking at this case study, and I'll, you know, for those who feel that I'll send the case study to give you something to think about as well, is how would you then take this concept of FICA, looking at faith, influence, community, and addressing the issues to help this 22-year-old young woman who is broken to the core and is about to or is making a decision on whether or not she wants to bring a little person in this world who's going to start off broken. So we don't, unfortunately, I didn't have enough time to go through the whole thing, but I wanted to kind of give you something to think about. I want to say thank you very much for being a part of the presentation. I hope you have... Yes, I do. I hope you have taken something away from this that you'll be able to use, and I appreciate your time.
We hope that you enjoyed this training. Please remember to take the post-test and the course evaluation in order to receive your CEU certificate. If you have any additional input or questions, please don't hesitate to contact us at the information you can find on our main webpage or email us at info@nacsw.org. We hope that you will consider taking additional courses on topics sensitive to the thoughtful integration of faith, spirituality, and social work practices through our program. Thanks again, and thanks for supporting NACSW.